Hey, hockey fans. Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hello and welcome to Future Projection. This is episode 153 of the show. Today's episode is a special one for the show. Myself and Ben had an interview with Paul Davis, who was most recently the Atlanta Braves pitching director. So we spent a good chunk of time talking about all things pitching with Paul. I thought it was a really fun and interesting, insightful conversation. And hopefully you guys will enjoy it as well. We recorded it a few weeks before it's going live, but wanted to make sure you guys had something to listen to over the holidays to continue to get your baseball fix. So hopefully you enjoy the interview as much as we did while doing it. So I'll just throw it straight to the interview. Enjoy, guys.
All right. We are happy to be joined by Paul Davis, who has spent a number of years in the game. He served 6 years with the Cardinals, where he was a minor league pitching coach. He was also the team's coordinator of pitching analytics. He had a brief stint with the Mariners, where he was the pitching coach for the big league team. And then for the past 6 years, he's been with the Braves, where he was pitching coordinator. And then most recently, the director of pitching for the organization. So, Paul, thank you for coming on the podcast. Excited to pick your brain and just learn a little bit more about pitching today.
Yeah, thank you, Carlos and Ben. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, so I guess to get into it, if there's anything that I did not mention about your background in the game that's relevant or you want to touch on, please feel free to add or contextualize or point out anything else that I missed on. I know I kind of ran down it really quickly, but you've been in the game for a while. You played in college. You coached in college. So you've been at really all the levels of baseball. But again, please add anything if I missed out.
I've coached kids from, eight to the major leagues. Had a little stretch in there where I went to grad school. I was pursuing a PhD in essentially sports psychology, leadership development, some coaching oriented things. Have done some sport psychology consulting for an org, baseball org, some college basketball teams. I've done a lot of different things and love golf. Play a lot of golf when I can, and so that's kind of me in a nutshell.
It does feel like if you're a pitcher, you kind of are required to like golf and play golf. So I guess for someone very involved in the pitching side of the game, that tracks.
Well, I grew up in Central Florida and had a chance to play golf as a young kid, and when I was about 15, just decided that it was way easier to throw fastballs by people than make 5 and 10 foot putts. So
tremendous. Well, I guess, yeah. Paul, as we get into this, can you kind of give us an overview of exactly what the job of a pitching director for a big league organization actually entails? I'm sure people have probably a vague understanding of what that is, but if you want to like tell us like what that actual job is and what the responsibilities are, that'd be awesome.
Sure. I think, first of all, it's really evolved where, as with other areas in the front office, there has been, let's call it some title inflation that when you get certain people, you have to, you want to keep people or you want to bring in new people, you add some different things. Essentially, when I first started, teams just had a pitching coordinator, and that was the guy who was a conduit between the front office and the minor league system, if you will, coaching coaches, having communication with the farm director, maybe assistant GMs. And I will say that I was hired in 2013 by my good friend Brent Strom. In fact, you know, there's a picture of he and I behind me in my office. He was the pitching coordinator for the Cardinals, and I had met him in 2001 at a Tom House pitching confab, if you will, three-day deal in San Diego. And so the coordinator would be involved in maybe hiring coaches at, you know, all levels. And at that point, teams would have six or seven minor league affiliates. So you've got a 120, 150 pitchers in the org. And that guy is kind of overseeing all of them, you know, where they're going to go, when they get promoted, how are they pitching? And you travel around to each affiliate, check in. You know, you're having conversations with the pitching coaches at those affiliates quite often. And so, you know, now it's evolved to where, you know, one, we have fewer teams, you know, after COVID and the realignment. There's no short season teams anymore. But essentially, you know, you're involved in also kind of setting some strategy, overall direction of, you know, where you're going. I think some teams now with a director of pitching are trying to do things a little differently. I have some thoughts that I think you could, if you really wanted to maximize a role like that, where, and I know some teams are trying to do this, to where you are collaborating and working closely with the athletic training department, the strength and coordinating guys, strength and conditioning coordinators, with scouting directors. Okay, that you know, if you just look at, all right, how are we going to take amateur pitchers and turn them into a major league pitcher, and especially a championship pitcher, because there's all 30 teams are essentially at some point, they, whether it's short term today or long term, 3-4 years from now, trying to win a World Series. And in order to do that, you've got to have some pitchers that are really good. So that's essentially an overview of really what the job would entail.
Yeah, you talked about the collaboration with other departments, including the amateur department. Obviously, when you were with the Braves, it seemed like maybe until this year it was automatic. You guys were drafting pitcher early on. How much collaboration or input did you have into the draft process or communication with the scouting department pre-draft on maybe some of the priority arms that the Braves were looking at in the draft? Or was the role really more, you know, once the Braves draft a pitcher, then it's like, all right, then we have, you know, the more influence in the conversation.
With the Braves, well, I'll backtrack slightly, because when I was with the Cardinals, when I first was hired by the Cardinals, they wanted to start analyzing amateur pitchers, looking at deliveries, some work that Jeff Luno had started, I believe, when he had been there, and then Tim Levesque, who became a really close colleague of mine. Tim was a young pitching coach there. And so we had a team of guys, and Tim and I developed some metrics. And then we would, analyze video that maybe it was from the scouting bureau, from clips, or sometimes we would get our own. It evolved to where scouts could get some. And so that was baked into evaluating pitchers. So then when I went to the Braves, I talked about this. We collaborated, created some things with some of the analysts, and so I would grade some guys. As time went on, and I didn't have as much time, and they added some things, tweaked some things. They would still do some of that analysis, but for the most part, it was a matter of, okay, this is what we're trying to find. And it's really changed too, because there's so much more information now. Even 2019, 2020, 2021, you didn't have as much TrackMan data from college pitchers. You might have a couple hundred pitches that the biggest schools that had TrackMan. Now there's information on just about everybody. And the high school guys, if they pitch in any type of travel summer ball stuff, you've got some information. So that gets baked in. So we know a little bit about it, about pitchers. We know a lot more. And then it's a matter of, okay, here's what this guy has done. What do we need to, you know, try and change perhaps, or what is a strength? I'm a huge believer in strengths and trying to develop those. So, you know, I think for the most part, teams and, you know, a director of pitching, coordinators, those guys, we know a lot more now about guys when they walk in the door than we did 10, 12, 13 years ago.
Yeah, you mentioned a lot of the checkpoints or markers that you were looking at earlier in terms of the development with the Cardinals, looking at pitchers with their deliveries and mechanics. What are some of those key points that you're looking for when you're breaking down a pitcher, either looking on video or live, or maybe some other analytical markers that you're looking at in terms of the pitcher's delivery or arm action that you're either looking to see, or maybe some red flags too, where you're like, I don't know, this this is something that worries me.
Yeah, so there are some things now that I think you can certainly see. There's much more high speed video, at least 240 frames per second. So that makes it way easier. And I will also add that there's a thing, if you guys have heard about this, the Newt Force pitching mound. It's been developed, really 2020 was when they started rolling it out. The Braves, we were one of the first adopters, if you will. We had multiple of them. A lot of guys threw off of it. I've learned a ton. You know, initially, you know, we didn't know as much about it. I've collaborated with guys like Wes Johnson and Kyle Barker, the owner, the developer of the Newt Mound. And so, you know, I've come to the point where, and it's similar to golf, okay, that I've said this for a long time, the world of golf is way ahead of baseball, that they have done things, they've learned things, they're using more, you know, they were using TrackMan way before we did. They started using force plates. They've understood what the force sequence should look like. And so there actually is a sequence that, and I think now I've gotten to where I can see this fairly well, even in video of a pitcher, because I've seen enough guys throw off of this thing and what good and bad looks like. Now, that being said, I will say it's really difficult. I've found this over 13 years that you can identify some things that are problematic, and it's really hard to get guys to change. It really is. And I think, you know, for the industry, this is something that the industry is grappling with the number of pitcher injuries. And my view is pitchers get hurt because of poor movement. Okay. And I would say it's any thrower. And I've looked at, you know, I've talked with guys who are high level coaches of shot putters, world-class shot putters, javelin throwers, discus throwers. Throwing is throwing, whether you're throwing a baseball, a football, a shot put, a javelin, you see the kinetic sequence. It's the same. And so, you know, you see javelin throwers that end up having Tommy John. It doesn't happen with quarterbacks very often. Usually they get hit and something happens, creates a huge amount of torque. You know, golfers will have different injuries that happen. Could be back, knee, etc. And usually in all of these cases, there's some issue with how they're moving. The issue that I see with pitching with a baseball is the baseball only weighs 5 ounces. And so there's a whole lot of degrees of freedom that you can move in a manner that's not really efficient, that the sequence is not great. And you could still be somewhat effective, at least over the short term. You can throw hard. You can throw enough strikes. May not be very healthy. Okay. You may be a guy that tears your UCL, you have shoulder issues, et cetera. But even though we can identify these things, I think it's really difficult to try to solve. And the pitcher has to be really aware of that. And I think it also ties into everyone try to get everyone on board. In my view, I will say that not everyone has this view. There would be a lot of people in the medical community that might tell me I'm crazy, that you can't see these things, and it's guys get hurt just because throwing a baseball is inherently hard. They're producing large amounts of torque, you're moving extremely fast. And again, no matter what you're throwing, whether you're a world-class shot putter or javelin thrower, or you're a major league pitcher, your body is rotating extremely fast. The humerus and the elbow are accelerating at extremely high rates of speed, and you can easily tear ligaments, tendons, muscles, break bones, what have you. So long way of answering that.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about the difficulty of changing pitchers in terms of the way that they move. I mean, Carlos and I talked about this sometimes on the hitter side too, where people will look at a hitter and say, oh, well, if we can just change this guy's swing to get him to hit the ball in the air more or something like that, we think he can make this big breakout. Well, okay, a lot easier said than done, I'm sure, when a guy's probably been moving a certain way his whole life to try to break those kind of movement patterns. When you're looking at a pitcher and you're trying or you're considering to make an adjustment to his arm action or his delivery, are there things that you see that are simpler fixes that you think are relatively easier for a pitcher to change? And then on the other end of the spectrum too, are there elements of a pitcher's delivery or his arm action where you're like, this is either going to be really hard to change or just not even worth bothering to change, because if we do, it might screw something else up with him?
That can become a question at times. Now, I think, you get into the issue of, well, is this guy, do we think he can be a starting pitcher or is he going to be a reliever? Certainly when you look at the roles, a major league pitcher is going to go out and he's going to throw, let's call it, 15 to 30 pitches, 4 out of 6 days. That's what you're trying to get to. A major league starter, we hope, can throw 100 pitches once every 5 or 6 days. And so it's no different to me. It's no different than if I were a track coach and I'm training runners. You see some guys who, the way their body is built and how they move, they're sprinters. And they're going to sprint max effort for 100 meters, 200 meters. And then you have the guys who are 1500, 3000 meter runners. And so I've always kind of compared that to a starter and a reliever, that the relievers are sprinters. And, certainly there's things that you can do just a little bit differently. This is an old school thing. People, have used this forever, still using it. Put a guy on the mound, hit him a comebacker, have him throw the ball to second, and let's see where his arm is. When his brain turns off and he just has to catch the ball and throw to second base, where did his arm go? And oftentimes it's a lot lower than where it would be when he pitches.
That's interesting.
And I think for some of this, a lot of it is, if you think back to, did either of you guys ever pitch?
No, in little league, yeah. But not in high school, I was just a hitter.
Okay, so if you think about young kids and pitching, we could go to little league fields anywhere, I think, in the universe, okay, in the world, whether we went to Latin America somewhere or Omaha or Maine or Texas, okay, go to Australia. Most kids, they get on a mound. I think about where are they going to miss? Where will a lot of their misses be as far as the strike zone goes? It's going to be high, okay? And so now they get told universally, get the ball down. And so in their brain, and especially I think what happens is you see a whole lot of pitchers who are taller kids. That's just, you know, the kids who are taller, more mature at any level, they'll typically throw a little harder perhaps. They get put on the mound. Well, now they're missing high. They get told, get the ball down. And what do? In order to get the ball down, you will make some move to compensate to get your arm higher in order to get the ball down. And so
just
now,
thinking of Hurston Waldrop right now as you're describing that.
Well, yeah, yeah. And so that then becomes, you have a little success, and so now that becomes your way of throwing the ball down the mound. I'll tell you a good example of a guy who changed is Logan Webb. If you look at Logan Webb when he signed out of high school up until maybe high A, he was your traditional, typical high three-quarter guy. And I don't remember if it was before or after his TJ, but he lowered his slot. Now, the way to teach that, and again, I'm finding some of this is easier using something like the Newt force mound, because the ground force is telling you the posture and the sequence, the timing of what your body is doing. Okay, if that makes sense. And in golf, again, this is being used to a great degree. So getting a guy to understand and to be able to see, oh, okay, this is what it looked like. If I did this, and the thing about pitching is you go from back leg, the first part of your delivery, when you load your hip, your arm, you're on your back leg, period, 100%. Your front leg is in the air. Then as you turn your body, you rotate to deliver the ball, you land on your front leg, and essentially your back leg is not putting any force into the ground. So you go from 100% back leg to 100% front leg. The trick is, how do you create the momentum, the timing, and the sequence to move optimally and efficiently wherever your spine angle is and whatever posture? You could be here, here, here. It doesn't really matter. You could be, you know, a submariner. You could be Rogers and throwing from way down here, Chad Bradford. And so it's really getting guys to understand how to control their spine, how to sequence what their shoulder does and their back hip. If you look at, this is one, if I said to you, Greg Maddux and Max Scherzer's deliveries are nearly identical from the top of their leg lift, what would you say?
I'd be surprised.
Okay, they are. I have the video.
Yeah.
I am convinced. I would love, I don't know the answer to this. I asked a couple people that I know, media people, if they could find out. They weren't able to find this out for me. I believe that Max Scherzer and probably his father modeled his delivery after Greg Maddux. He was, do the math, he was a young boy, 10, you know, 9, 10, 12 years old, when Maddux was at his peak. What number has Max worn throughout his career? Number 31. What number did Maddux wear? Number 31. And so when you look at them, you see the timing and the sequence is eerily similar. The only difference is that Maddux was kind of here and Scherzer is more here.
Yeah.
Well, as you're talking about like some of the delivery things, I wanted to back up a little and more generally ask you, because Ben was asking if there are any traits that are inherently more difficult or easier to change or develop or coach. Are there just any traits generally for pitchers that you feel like are innate and very difficult to teach? And then vice versa, what have you found to be the traits that are maybe easiest to tinker with a pitcher when you get them into a pro setting to maybe help unlock a little bit more?
Well, I think the biggest is psychologically, that if you think about it, this is the beauty of baseball to me. And, you know, probably one reason why personally I gravitated to pitching is pitcher versus hitter. This is what baseball is all about. Okay. 90% of the game is that mano a mano, confrontation. And baseball's not, you know, where you can't give the ball to Mike Trout over and over and over again, or you can't have Aaron Judge bat every single inning. That it's me against this guy, the next guy. Okay, then I'm going to face him the next time through and the next time through. And so I think that the great pitchers are inherently hyper-competitive, that and this is something I'm not sure that you can teach. You can, and I will say that I have tried as someone who can build the culture within an organization. I've tried to create a competitive culture. I think you can you know, try to maximize it. You can reward it. But that's just something, it's not going to go away. That's just the game of baseball, and the great pitchers have this, and they have it when they walk in the door. They probably had it when they were 8 years old, the very first time they got on a mound. They understood that.
I feel like from the outside looking in, it's probably pretty easy to assume everyone who's gotten into pro baseball has that competitive drive, but even in that subset of players, there probably is just separating competitive mindsets. And I remember just playing sports and you'd have really talented players, even at the high school level, who just didn't work and didn't care. And I would have coaches that say, you know, I can't want it more than you. And so there was always some like left on the table if you weren't willing to actually go work for it and go get it. So that's interesting to think, just about how even at that level where we assume everyone is elite and has this intense mindset and is ready to go after it, there's still a separator there mentally.
There is without question. This was one of the areas I've done some consulting in, and I'm, you know, thinking of doing more, but it's so competitive at that level of, you know, Major League Baseball. It's no different than if it's the NFL, the NHL, the NBA. In fact, I just read a quote about quote from Shai Gilgeous-Alexander this week, talking about how Oklahoma City is dominating and what his thought process is. And it's a fantastic quote that gives you an idea of what his motivations are, what he values, what drives him. And, you know, that stuff, there are differences, trust me, that, you know, certain guys just want to be great and will do whatever they have to do. And they organize their daily activities around doing that. Because, you know, this is the other thing to understand, that when you get to professional baseball, you're not going to win all the time. In fact, I'm reading a book right now that Scott Miller wrote about managers. It's a fantastic book. And he has a chapter about Dave Roberts. And I'm not sure what the numbers would be now, but Dave Roberts, his winning percentage is one of the best of all time as a manager so far. And it's, you know, in the 62-63% range. Okay. So, you know, think about that, right? He's been with an organization that has been phenomenal. So
you can have it, I pulled up his managerial record, and it is exactly that, 621 currently for his career.
Yeah. So, you know, if you were a pitcher and you had a 621, and I'm not sure what Kershaw's career winning percentage ended at, if you pull that up, you know, we talk all the time about hitters, that if a hitter fails 70% of the time, they're fantastic. Mm-hmm. And pitchers.
Kershaw's, it's kind of crazy. Kershaw's is 699.
Yeah, one of the greatest. I think it might be the highest of all time. If you set the cutoff, right?
Yeah.
So he's winning 70% of the time. That's just unheard of. But yet, when you think about the average guy, a first round pick, let's call it, you know, who first round picks, hey, these guys should be in the big leagues. These are the guys that the industry thinks they have the highest chance of success. Well, when they're in high school, they won way more than 62 or 69% of the time.
Right.
Okay. They're not losing. They get to college. Okay. They still can win at a super high rate. Now you get to pro baseball, where there are the best players, and especially you get to the major leagues. You're not going to win all the time. You have to be able to accept the fact that, yes, I'm going to go out there and compete my rear end off. And if I win 60% of the time, that's unbelievable. I'm going to be one of the best guys in the game. Mm-hmm. And so that's another thing that I think you have to try to, you know, my perspective was to try to prepare guys for that. And especially you see it all the time, that it's rare for top prospects to get into, they make their debut in their first year, they often struggle, mm-hmm. you know, or at least for a certain period of time. I mean, you look at Glavin, Maddux, and Smoltz, all three of those guys struggled their first, let's call it first full season, you know, if it was a half a season, whatever it was, you know, horrible losing records. Now, it was a pretty bad team in some ways, but, and that's the other part of it. Like, you think of all the guys that come up with teams that maybe aren't that good around them, mm-hmm. and they're going to lose. May not be through any fault of theirs, but they're going to have to learn how to accept that, how to deal with it, and continue to compete. And I think that's one of the separators.
This whole conversation, thinking about like the mentality and the winning mentality you need and the work ethic here, it reminds me of Spencer Strider, who is a guy that I definitely wanted to get to in this conversation, because I feel like his developmental path is just very interesting. His win-loss record, by the way, right now is 619 so far in his career. So pretty good start there for him. But Spencer Strider, to me, was a player who I was light on covering him as a prospect. He was a notable guy coming out of high school. He goes to college. He gets hurt, kind of falls back under the radar a little bit. The Braves wind up drafting him in the fourth round. And then I feel like he really reset at least my expectations for what a starter can be, with just a very rare but dominant two-pitch mix. I'm curious about just your experience working with Spencer, what that player development path was like, and maybe the takeaways from working with such a unique pitcher like him.
Sure. So the first thing with Spencer was I had seen video of him, graded him when he was in high school with the Cardinals. I've said this before publicly. I told our scouting group with the Cardinals, just give this guy whatever he wants. Okay. You watch the video of him in high school, and there were things in his delivery that, that I was, you know, somewhat concerned about. With today's knowledge, yeah, I'd be, you know, a lot more concerned, but the way his fastball moved, that, you know, you see video at 94, 95, and it just exploded, which now, you know, this is elite vertical movement. It's elite, you know, vertical approach angle. And so Yeah, he doesn't. He gets drafted late by the Indians. Guardians doesn't sign. He goes to Clemson. Was just so-so his freshman year. If you look at video of him or data when he went to the Cape after his freshman year, and I said this to talk that I gave to a group of Brave Scouts. He averaged 89.4 that summer on the Cape. How many, and don't feel bad about being light on him, Carlos. would you write a report on this guy who's averaging 89.4 and he's 6 foot generously? And would you say, yep, 3 years from now, or what was it? That was the summer of 2018,
looks like.
Okay. Yeah. 2018. You're going to write a report and say, 4 years from now, he's going to set a record as the fastest guy to 200 strikeouts in the history of Major League Baseball.
Yeah.
And he's going to be touching 100 with his fastball. There's no chance. No one would have done that.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't. I mean, as much as you want to project or see things. And so now, a year later, he tears his UCL. He has talked about this. He was extremely meticulous, and to his credit, this is the type of person that he is. He said, I had to do some soul searching, and that, yeah, before that, I thought I had a good delivery. Well, I just tore my UCL, so obviously there's something going wrong there. So he started watching a lot of video of Ryan and some other, you know, elite pitchers, and worked with the training staff there who he was rehabbing with at Clemson, and started trying to make some adjustments. So he comes out in 2020, and his first start, he was 90-91. It wasn't great as far as how he was moving, but then you could see it by the fourth start. He's starting to figure a few things out. He's throwing harder, and he ends up being a fourth round pick. Mm-hmm. By the Braves, and I will say that when I saw that he was on our list, and I said, yeah, I would really like this guy, we took him, and I was like, yay. Okay. But he shows up at, we brought him to the alternate site that year, and I think it's the alternate site was really interesting from a developmental standpoint, because you couldn't have a lot of guys there, but there was no there wasn't a scoreboard. Mm-hmm. Okay. But so with Spencer, all we wanted to do was to build him up to 80 pitches, that we're going to take this slow. And it was, I don't know, probably end of July when we, you know, started playing games again, and it would be 2-3 times a week, something like that. Maybe 4, I don't remember, but we would have a scrimmage, and we had guys like Ian Anderson and Kyle Muller and Tucker Davidson, Tukey Toussaint, Kyle Wright. They made some appearances there. So we got to keep these guys on a starters type schedule. And then we had Spencer there, a couple other guys that we're just going to filter in. So, okay, today I've got 5 innings that we're going to play a game. And sometimes it was 6-on-6 or 7-on-7, basically. You know, everyone around the game was doing this. But so Spencer started out as an inning, then an inning, 2 innings, okay? And by mid-October, we had a little prospect camp. We brought in some guys. He made a couple starts, got up to 5 innings, his 80 pitches. And he had things that he was trying to do with his delivery, and I would make some suggestions. Hey, I think, you know, this might be better, or you don't need this, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, a lot of feel on his part. And he was throwing a 4-seamer, a curveball, and a changeup. He pitched 17 innings in that little stretch there, basically from 1st of August to mid-October.
Mm-hmm.
And he walked 24 guys.
Yeah.
We had to roll his innings almost all the time.
Yeah.
You know, until he was facing those last 2 times or last start, I don't know if he made 1 or 2 against age similar competition, he blew mm-hmm. those guys away. But the curveball was not very good. Mm-hmm. A little slow. It had, you know, He had a hard time throwing it for a strike. Changeup was atrocious. And I felt at the time like, okay, we need to work on a slider. So, you know, at the end, we try and throw a few sliders, very cutterish, and you know, he goes home over the winter.
So really quickly to interject there, when you're just starting that process, is it just like, hey, here's some pitch grips to try, throw a few, see how it feels? What? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And we still, we had TrackMan and Edger at that point in 2020. But yeah, it's just take a certain grip or two and all right, let's throw this thing here and see what it looks like. Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, he's throwing 7, 8, 9 vert sliders, very, very cutterish. And I had said, okay, I want you to really work on this over the winter. And, you know, again, the whole COVID thing, we didn't know what's going to happen, yada, yada. Spring training 2021, we come back and there were, if you remember that year, there were two separate, there was going to be major league spring training, no minor leaguers around. You could only have a certain number of players there. Then we're going to have a separate minor league camp a little later. The minor league season was going to start May 1st or 5th or something like that. Well, we were able to get he and a couple other guys in to major league camp, but we did, you know, this is after a week or 10 days or whatever, but we're going to go in the backfield. Mm-hmm. And I had it lined up. So, you know, Bryce Elder was one of them. Typical thing. Yeah, we're going to throw a side 2 days, throw another one, and then we'll throw a live BP. Well, Spencer's first two sides were absolutely awful. And he had not worked on the slider. He's still trying to throw the curveball, trying to throw a changeup. He's bouncing curveballs and changeups 48 feet, throwing fastballs over catchers, hitting the TrackMan unit.
Sounds like a scene from Major League.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, myself and my assistant at the time, Cale Johnson, who's now the pitching coach at Dallas Baptist. And we had seen Spencer all the video from high school and everything, and we're at wit's end. So I said, okay, we'll throw another side. That one wasn't great. And I made a decision at that point. And, you know, Ben Sustanovich agreed with me, spur of the moment. I said, Spencer, we're throwing the curveball and the changeup away. You're not going to throw them. You're throwing four seamers, and we're going to try and throw every one of them at the top of the strike zone. And we're going to throw a slider to go with it. And you're going to go to Augusta to start the year, low A. He pushed back briefly. But then I will say that the very next side he threw again 2 days later was electric. And from that point on, you know, all throughout 2021, yeah, he goes to Augusta, totally dominated people in like four starts.
He struck out 32 batters, walked 5, 15 innings and 4 starts.
Yeah. Then he goes to Rome, similar success. He goes to Double A. And he was essentially in Double A the rest of the year. And it, you know, it was a little up and down there at times, but we had a really good Double A team that year. I mean, there were, you know, some guys that went through there, you know, quite a few have ended up pitching and playing in the big leagues, and they won the Southern League Championship, beat the Rays team. So he just really worked at it. I mean, you know, he knew what he wanted to do. And again, and this was where my belief, I hold this belief, okay, that, you know, pitching is really the rules of the game, okay, and the strike zone tell you what is going to work. Okay. The rules of the game are three strikes. If you were to look at the swing rate in the big leagues with no strikes, it's minuscule. Okay. It's minuscule, being less than 50%. With one strike, there's more swings. With two strikes, there's a whole lot of swings. Okay. And chases go up. The game has always been this way. Hitters have always done their damage before two strikes. Pitchers have always dominated with two strikes. Okay. So the name of the game is, I have to be able to throw my fastball four strikes. And I'm a believer that if I'm throwing a four seam fastball, that is backspinning that will be tending to move to the top of the strike zone, I need to try and throw it in the upper half of the strike zone. If I'm a sinker guy, I need to throw my sinker in the bottom half of the zone. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying with no strikes. I am not trying to hit a corner. I am coming right at you and looking to throw a strike. Everything else will play off of that. And in Spencer's case, the strike zone was more vertical. Okay. And this is something that I began to notice probably in 2016, 2017 for sure, that the strike zone in the big leagues had gotten more vertical. It started to look much more like this. And there were a lot more high strikes. And so, well, what is this going to do? You know, how does this inform our strategy and our tactics? And what will it do to results and, mm-hmm. and the guys that can execute this? And so Spencer, you know, he perfected, if you look at his numbers in 2022 and 2023, he was throwing his fastball with, call it, you know, a whole lot of fastballs with 17 plus vertical inches of movement and a vertical approach angle in the top third to slightly above the zone at roughly negative 3.5 degrees, which is extremely flat.
Yep.
And then his slider, when he threw his slider in the bottom third and under the zone, it was in the 8.5 plus range. So you had 5 degrees of vertical separation. So now think about if I'm a hitter and I'm trying to hit a 98 mile an hour fastball or more at that flat 3.5, and I've got to gear up to hit that. And now all of a sudden it's not that.
Yeah.
and it's 85 or 87 mm-hmm. at -8.5. That's extremely difficult to deal with.
Yeah.
You can't adjust to that.
This isn't just a game. It's a once in a generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Drinking and driving is a decision that will change your whole world. Things will never be the same once you get a DUI, because legal fees and time in court are just the beginning. Getting into a crash is another way your world could be irreversibly changed after drinking and driving. Your vehicle may not be the only thing that gets damaged in that crash. You could face a life-altering injury or even death. But you're not the only one who could face those consequences. Your decision to drink and drive could permanently change someone else's world, whether you injure them or leave their loved ones grieving. The next time you're out drinking, call a rideshare, a taxi, a sober friend, or a designated sober driver. Always plan for a safe ride home. The only decision that'll change your world for the better is the decision to call for a sober ride. It's never worth it to drive drunk. Don't risk it. Drive sober or get pulled over. Paid for by NHTSA.
Yeah, and go ahead, Ben.
Oh, no, go ahead, Carlos.
Yeah, I was just going to ask with that. The biggest holdup for me when writing, even at that stage after Strider's 2021 season, the critique you always heard, especially from people outside of the org, was, okay, it's a very heavy fastball slider diet. And for so many years, it's like you have to have three pitches if you want to profile as a starter. You need a changeup, you need a third piece. But with Strider, I feel like it was just an example of if your first two pitches are dominant enough, and maybe it's the fact that north-south approach is pretty platoon neutral. You can attack both righties and lefties with both those pitches with equal effectiveness. Maybe that was the separator. But for me, it just kind of opened my eyes and said, okay, you can be a starter at the major league level if your two elite pitches that you're throwing for strikes are at such a high level that you're missing bats consistently. And that I think just maybe opened my eyes a little bit more to like a typical starter convention. But it's really fascinating to hear about his path. And Ben, if you want to follow up more in secondaries, that's fine too.
Yeah, I was just saying it's interesting to hear about the evolution of the secondary stuff that you were talking about with Spencer Strider that he had when he was coming up. when you're trying to help a pitcher develop a breaking ball, whether it, you know, whether it's a curveball or a slider, how much do you think that's just an innate ability to be able to spin an effective breaking ball versus something that you're able to teach a pitcher?
Well, there is some innateness to it, and I'll give another guy as an example that I worked some with when I was with the Cardinals, Luke Weaver. That Luke showed up and he had a great changeup, and I was in the draft room when Weaver was drafted, and there was a big debate among scouts that, well, you know, yeah, the fastball is going to play, he's got a great changeup, but he doesn't have a breaking ball, you know, he's never going to be a starter. And I do think there is, and I think the data would bear this out a little bit. It may be different for left-handed pitchers. And I asked Luke right away, like, okay, how long have you had a great changeup? Always had it. So when he was 10, 11, 12 years old, he was taught a changeup and it just came naturally. I think there's something to this where, and I saw it with other guys, I've seen it with a lot of guys, when you're throwing a breaking ball, you're trying to rip it and really spin it. And a changeup is about, you know, this is where splitters, and I'll segue slightly, splitters have helped tremendously because
you Ben can is a huge fan of the splitter, if you did not know. He's a big proponent, which is people throw it more.
And that's really changing. That's one of the things that has changed a ton, in, you know, even in the last 5 years. But I think there, you know, there is something to that, that some guys, you know, oftentimes, well, just often you see, especially right-handers that can really rip breaking balls, spin it. They have a hard time taking spin off. It's like your brain just doesn't compute. You want me to throw the ball slower with less spin. And I think also the guys that have really good fastballs, what you see on Edgertronic videos, their hand is right here. Okay, their hand is here, it comes through, and that's what creates the backspin. Well, now if you take the traditional changeup grip and you've got a ball right here, you know, and you're trying to do, you know, something like this circle, etc. Okay, they end up throwing it the same way, and it's just a slow fastball, okay, that just, you know, it doesn't have a whole lot of depth to it. So throwing the splitter, what we found is, yeah, you just throw the splitter and the lack of spin, the thing just goes down. The other thing is, I think, you know, the kick change to me is essentially a splitter, because instead of some guys have a hard time throwing a splitter here or finding the right split, but I can take my ring finger and my index finger and split it, and I'm going to get pretty much the same effect. It's just a matter of toying around with variations of grips. And I think that's one thing that is helping. I will say this, that, you know, in my time with the Braves, we threw more sliders than any organization. And there's a reason for that. My belief is, and you look at the numbers, sliders get more swings and misses than curveballs. Curveballs are, you know, in the old days, okay, and I think this is something that's changed since I started in 2013. There's fewer and fewer curveballs because with data, the people have realized it's hard to throw a curveball for a strike in the strike zone. It comes out differently. You have to get the curveball to have a positive release angle. And it's just harder to throw that pitch in the zone. And if you're not getting it in the zone, you're not going to get swinging strikes later in counts.
I believe in the last 5 years, the slider rate across the league is north of 20% and increasing, and the curveball rate across the league is sub 10%. And in the early 2000s, it was kind of right at that 10% mark. So,
yeah. So, and the other thing is, what does, when a slider and a splitter come out of a pitcher's hand, what do they look like?
Pretty similar to the fastball, no? Or
they look like fastballs.
Yeah.
Okay. So to be a major league hitter, you have to be able to hit fastballs. If you can't hit fastballs, you're not going to be a successful major league hitter. And by successful, I mean an everyday guy. Okay. So if this population of hitters, the best hitters in the world, hit fastballs, you know, this is what's, again, what has happened since I started in baseball. We now know that, yes, these guys hit fastballs, and we want to randomize. So the percentage of fastballs has gone down closer to 50%, if not below 50%, because now, okay, he's got to stay on the fastball. But if I can throw a pitch, I mean, Trey Yesavage, slider, splitter. He's got two pitches that come out of his hand looking like a fastball. If he's throwing his fastball for strikes, good luck.
Because we saw that in the playoffs. He was landing his pitches for strikes in one game and dominated. I think the first postseason game, he was struggling to find the zone and the hitters could lay off. And to your point about fastballs going down, 2006, the league fastball rate was north of 60%. 2025, 48%.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and that's what has really changed. The other thing that has changed is when I first started in pro baseball in 2013, what you thought the quality of a fastball was all about was velocity. Mm. Now we know that velocity is just one piece of it. It's going to be the spin, the vertical movement, the approach angle, you know, if you're going to throw a sinker, it needs to be a good sinker. You don't want to throw a dead zone fastball. So you see a whole lot of guys like the Red Sox, you know, in the last 2 years or whatever, they're just trying to eliminate dead zone fastballs. And you see that with guys now also where, you know, what's happened is, and we started doing this with several guys last year, multiple fastballs. There are more guys now that are throwing who have let's call it an okay four seamer, but especially against opposite handed hitters, they're going to throw a cutter.
This is an interesting, I feel like, wrinkle, because I feel like maybe 5 years ago, you heard about everyone trying to give their pitcher a cut ride fastball, shorten up the arsenal and throw a hard gyro slider. And I feel like the last few years, you've heard a lot more about pitchers really diversifying their arsenal, throwing multiple fastball shapes, throwing multiple breaking ball shapes. I mean, J.R. Richie is maybe the example to point to in the Braves system, who seemingly can just break out a new shape every other game. But it does feel like we're now hearing a lot more about how teams are trying to add, whereas even with young players in a lot of orgs, sometimes the move is, hey, let's simplify the arsenal and help them work on a few individual pitches. But as you progress, you kind of need to have a deeper bag.
Well, I think there's a reason for it, actually. And so, as I mentioned, the rules of the game, three strikes, okay, how, you know, with zero strikes, I could throw the nastiest pitch ever. I could throw a 21 vert four seamer, or I could throw a 22 horizontal sweeper and I land it. And the hitter could just step back and say, hey, that was cool, but guess what? It's strike one. Or he could swing and miss. I could throw a nasty slider that, you know, drops off in the dirt and the guy chases it. Guess what? He's still hitting. Okay. So I'm going to have to execute pitches. I got to be able to throw it in the zone, or I need to make hitters swing. Okay, the other part of this is 86% of all swings result in either a strike or an out. Okay, between misses, foul balls, balls in play that are turned into an out, 86%. It's going to vary a little bit either way, depending upon the guy and the hitter, perhaps. But so, you know, my mantra has been make hitters swing. If 86%, I'll take our chances. Now, the other part of this is the strike zone. And so when I started in pro baseball in 2013, the strike zone, you'd still see some horizontal strikes being called that were a ball, two balls off the plate. Well, as Major League Baseball started grading umpires using technology, whether it was, I don't know, Quest Tech or then TrackMan, different things, you saw the strike zone begin to shrink, at least horizontally. It got higher vertically, okay? And so that's where I believed, like a guy like Strider, if I can throw a four-seamer, and I wouldn't try and take a lot of guys, and let's see, what kind of four-seamer can we throw? Mm-hmm. If it's at the top of the zone, what are its characteristics? And if I can do that, and I can pair the hard gyro slider with it, I can have some success. Mm-hmm. Now, by the way, Carlos, you know, your thought about in the industry, I think that pitchers need multiple pitches. If you go back to Tom Seaver, Bob Gibson, they were predominantly fastball slider. Hmm. They might change the shape and mix in a little curveball. Steve Carlton, fastball slider. Nolan Ryan, fastball curveball. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can go throughout history that there were a whole lot of elite major league pitchers that were predominantly two pitch guys, and there we had a whole era where it was sinker slider. Mm. Okay. That was what people are trying to do, because the strike zone allowed you to, if you think of, you know, the strike zone, I have got so many videos on my phone of Maddux.
Yeah. It's wide. It's real wide.
And when I first got to the Braves, and I gave a talk to all of our pitchers on this, and I showed a video of Maddux, you know, throwing to Eddie Perez, and Eddie's setting up 6 inches off the plate, and Eddie was in the audience, and he started laughing and said, "You're right. That's what was called." Mm-hmm. Those pitches are not called anymore. And with the ABS challenge, if you were to look at the strike zone and hitter behavior in AAA this past year, you'll have an inkling of what is going to happen in the big leagues. So the umpires in AAA, and big league umpires are going to do this just as quickly. Pitches that are just off the plate and even on the plate are not being called strikes. Okay. The strike zone has really shrunk down, and the ABS has shrunk the top of the zone. It has lopped off a ball, maybe two balls. Hmm. Off the top of the zone. Hitters are swinging less. And so I think that this has been one impetus, because I think what's happened is, in preparation for this, that the strike zone has kind of come down, okay, in the big leagues. It's been a little higher than what you would see in AAA. It's going to get smaller. So now you're going to have to use more pitches. You're going to need a deeper arsenal especially because you don't have the top of the zone.
Yep.
It's just not the same. So hitters aren't going to have to really battle with up and down. They're going to have to battle more with pitches that have a little bit more vertical movement. Okay. Per mile per hour. And I'll go back to maybe the best way to explain this is Greg Maddux used to talk about, he wanted to touch in a game, he wanted to touch every number on the radar gun between 72 and 92. Well, if you look at guys like Spencer Schwellenbach or J.R. Ritchie, and there's many others, if you were to take the vertical movement and velocity, you will see this stair step. And it's very intuitive if you think about it. Mm-hmm. If I take a fastball, the hardest pitch that I can throw with the most backspin, okay, I'm going to get the most vertical break, whatever that number is, the max of my four-seam fastball. And now you take a curveball. Curveball is going to have the most vertical break negatively. Mm-hmm. Okay. A Charlie Morton curveball down here. That's probably going to be my slowest pitch as well. So now I just simply fill in this gap, and I fill it in by simply changing the grip on pitches to get it to sink a little more. You know, up here, okay, I have my four seamer, you have a two seamer, You have a cutter that will probably move kind of similar. Okay, now I have a little harder slider version. Okay, I'm going to take a little off my slider and it's going to be slurvier. Okay, here's a changeup or a splitter or a sweeper over here. And now here's my curveball. And so the guys that can do that and can throw all of those pitches for strikes will, you know, one, okay, they have an arsenal that can become a little more platoon neutral because you're not, you won't throw every pitch, you know, maybe to lefties. If I'm a right-handed pitcher, to lefties, I'm going to be more cutter, changeup, curveball.
Right.
To righties, you know, and both guys, both sides, if I have two strikes and I happen to have a good fastball, say like a guy like Schwellenbach, okay, I can throw the four-seamer up to either side. But to righties, I'll throw a sinker, I'll throw the hard slider, maybe sweeper. And, you know, if a splitter is in there, okay, I can use the splitter to the righties as well.
Yeah.
So you can, you may be throwing six or seven pitches, but you only use four of them to one side or the other.
Yeah. That and makes sense.
That's, I think, the impetus of trying to do that.
Yeah. Well, you've been very nuanced here. I wanted to take a step back and ask maybe a simplistic question, but of these two pitcher types, which is more challenging to develop? And I guess, which would you rather have, a pitcher with great pure stuff but erratic control, or a pitcher with great command but maybe very light stuff?
Well, you know, I've thought about this, and I think you have to, again, this is the beauty of, to me, the beauty and the challenge of developing pitchers. I just want to help each of those guys figure out how to be successful. And it really is in the context of, as I'm, you know, I mentioned, you know, earlier here, when I was with the Cardinals, front office would come in and they would talk to our pitchers in spring training, you know, all of our minor league guys, what are you being evaluated on? Okay, we want to be transparent. You know, your wins, your one loss record, your ERA, that doesn't really matter. Okay, you can't control.
Okay, I'm very glad to hear that. I thought you were about to say those were stats we were looking at. I was about to cry.
No. So, you're going to be evaluated on walks, strikeouts, ground balls. Okay, now you know, and those things would, you know, I would still talk about that with guys, and it's a matter of if you get to be a big league pitcher, are you going to be a high strikeout guy? Well, if you're a high strikeout guy, you know, the major league average is 22-23%. It's been that way the last 4 years. Again, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the ABS challenge and how the zone will shrink up and how hitters will behave. But so are you going to be able to be a 25-29%, you know, probably if you're in 28% above in the big leagues, that's a legit strikeout pitcher.
Yep.
Okay. You can afford to be, if you're Tyler Glass now and you're punching out 29%, you can afford to walk 12%, 11-12%, whatever it is. Okay. Probably not going to be a ground ball guy. Now, if you're a heavy ground ball guy, and you know, often sinker guys or ground ball pitchers don't get as many strikeouts simply because they don't get foul balls early in counts. When guys swing, they put the ball in play. And when they put it in play, they put it in play on the ground, which gets converted into more outs. So if you're a high ground ball guy, you've got to be a low walk guy. You could be a low walk and lowish strikeouts and still be successful. Okay. So I would take those guys and say, all right, you know, you've got big stuff, the guys that have huge stuff, and they're walking too many people. You know, first of all, again, I try to look at it as I want to create a mindset where the pitcher is trying to make hitters swing. Like saying, hey man, you need to throw more strikes. Every professional pitcher is going to look at you and say, guess what? Yeah, I'm trying.
Thanks.
Okay. Right. Yeah, and I wanted to get into this. I'm glad that you're bringing it up because you guys have done this pretty nicely with or pitchers that you've worked with. You have seen them improve their walk rate, and then they'll move on to different orgs, and the walk rate jumps. The Rays are obviously very famous for getting all their pitchers to throw more strikes. Like, what is the best way to help pitchers throw more strikes? Because some orgs seemingly can do it, but to your point, like, no pitcher's going up there trying to throw a ball.
Exactly. Well, I think, again, the catchers are involved in this as well. And I am a firm believer that the catcher needs to sit on the plate. We're not trying to hit a corner, okay? Because what analytics have also shown us is we know now that the average major league pitcher misses his target by 12 to 14 inches, okay? 12 to 14 inches. I have fun with this when I, you know, I maybe go talk to some young kids or coaches and they'll, you know, I'll ask that question and they think that major league pitchers miss their target by 3 inches. Mm-hmm. No. Okay. We're throwing baseballs 60 feet, 6 inches, trying to throw it through this 18 by 18, now 18 by 20, whatever it is, box at 90 plus miles an hour or moving the way it is. And it, you know, if you miss 12 inches either way, that's a pretty good miss. Okay. So catchers need to sit on the plate and have a mindset of attack the strike zone with no strikes, with I've done things where in spring training, I offered guys $50 if they gave up an 0-0 home run. Give up a home run, 0-0, and I will give you $50.
Do they look at you like you were out of your mind? Or
They did until I paid off. Okay? Because, again, the idea is we want to be the house. You know, you show the numbers. Huge difference between starting account 1-0 versus 0-1. Even bigger difference between 1-2, 2-1. Okay, so within those first couple pitches, you have to have the mindset of, I am attacking the zone. I want you to swing. I'm going to throw pitches that hopefully you think they're so good that you'll swing. Because roughly, I mean, it's close to 40% of all swings result in a foul ball. So that's a strike. Mm-hmm. You know, depending upon your stuff or what pitch you throw, it's roughly another 30% are a miss. And then the rest get put in play. And we know that the BABIP is under 300. So 70, you know, right around 300. So 70% of those balls put in play are outs. If guys are going to get their damage, they're going to hit home runs, they're going to drive balls in the gaps before two strikes. But then the mindset is, okay, when I get to two strikes, I am going to try to throw pitches that look like strikes and they're not. Okay. That whether it's the splitter that drops below the zone, the slider that disappears, if I have a swing and miss fastball, you know, I go back to a guy that I coached in Seattle in 2019, Eric Swanson, who had a swing and miss fastball. That's all he had at the time. That he tried to start early, struggled. The slider he was throwing, you know, he'd been a curveball guy. It wasn't very good. We started teaching him a splitter. It was making progress. But he'd have games where then, you know, he moved to the bullpen, and he'd have games where he'd come in, he'd punch out 2 out of 3 guys, and they were on high fastballs. I remember a game he punched out Aaron Judge on a high fastball. And that swing and miss fastball ended up allowing him to have a nice career as a major league reliever. He ultimately developed a good sweeping slider and a splitter. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's the kind of stuff that I think that you're trying to do, just to create, to get guys to understand, I am going right at people trying to make the hitters swing. And yep. I reinforce that all the time with some, you know, the thing that I call the shove report, that gives guys some feedback on, you know, where they're throwing pitches, how often they're getting swings. That's something I talk to with guys and pitching coaches all the time.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a lot of the adjustments you're talking about aren't really something mechanical that you're trying to change with a pitcher. It's a lot of mental mindset, a more approach-oriented adjustments. Is it? I mean, we've talked to some pitchers who are with like the Rays or the Red Sox system, and they said, yeah, like they some of our coaches literally tell us to throw it right down the middle to try to throw more strikes. Is it? I mean, do you sometimes tell guys to do? I mean, I know you talked about the catchers setting up there. Is it sometimes just as simple as saying just throw it down the middle even?
Yes, and that's easier said than done. And now, even if you look at so let's say in the last decade, who have been the best hitting orgs in baseball? Three: Astros, Yankees, yeah. Dodgers. Okay, and if you were to pull up heat maps or zone maps, looking at where they miss fastballs, they are right at the top of the zone. Okay, down the middle, just above. Because again, that's what, as the strike zone has narrowed, hitters will say, oh, that pitch that looks to me like, okay, I'm up there at the plate and the guy delivers the ball and the first thing I see out of his hand is the ball appears like it's moving away from me. I'm not swinging. If it appears like it's coming at me, I'm not swinging. Okay, this is something that Andy McKay, who was the player development director with the Mariners when I was there, and he's now going to go coach with the Guardians, he would talk about this from a hitting standpoint, that hitters should be focused on down the middle, that's the area that you need to identify, because that's where, if you were to look at a heat map of slugging percentage, it's in the middle of the plate. Okay, so. Now, that being said, they don't hit home runs on all of those pitches. They pop a lot of them up. They foul them back. And now, if I can get guys to swing at a pitch early in a count, I'll get him to chase the same pitch or a pitch off of that with two strikes that looks like it's down the middle. And really, that's, to me, that's the art of pitching. And I think, you know, this is one where I would say, you know, velocity, movement, location. Okay. So now we know that more velocity is better. Okay. Every team has maps that show, okay, here movement on this pitch at this speed gets better results. Okay. We know this. Well, we know location matters. And with two strikes, oftentimes what you see is you get way more swings and misses on non-fastballs below the strike zone. You get about 50% plus more on those pitches. If they're located in the bottom third and below, okay, poster boy for this is Patrick Corbin. Dylan Lee is an example of this. If you were to look at with the naked eye, Patrick Corbin and Dylan Lee sliders, you'd say, man, they don't look great. But when they're in the bottom third of the zone, they play incredibly well, that hitters can't discern that, oh, that pitch is in the dirt and they're swinging at it. And that really, I think, is one of the arts of pitching, is being able to understand that as a pitcher and execute that. You know, we're trying to develop velocity, movement, and location as an instrument to get hitters out. Like, just in and of itself, if you throw 100, great, but you can't throw it over the plate, or you have 22 inches of sweep on a sweeper, but you can never throw it for a strike. It's not going to help you. And so you know, developing pitchers and, you know, helping guys succeed, it's this interplay of, well, how do we use velocity, movement, location, and the context? I've got to throw, the location needs to be in the zone before two strikes. With two strikes, I need to get it out of the zone and try to get hitters to chase.
Yeah, and most teams internally will have stuff models, right? Or even if not, you're getting the TrackMan or the Hawkeye readouts of each pitch for a pitcher. Do you feel like when you're looking at that data that it generally lines up with what you're seeing visually, or are there certain instances where you think the data or maybe somebody's interpretation of the data can be missing something about a pitch's effectiveness, where, you know, someone might look at a pitch and say, well, the shape isn't that great, I don't really like it. But then when you see the pitch and just the way the pitch actually plays against hitters or against hitters in certain situations, something else is happening that isn't necessarily captured by the models or by somebody's interpretation of the data.
Sure. I think that can happen. I think in general, what you see is the stuff grades on fastballs are, you know, not that good with a lot of guys. But it doesn't mean that you can't throw fastballs. Okay. Or you're going to have to throw some now. And again, certain sliders or splitters or changeups, model wise, stuff plus may not grade all that well, but the guy really executes it. Okay. He's able to get it in the bottom third. You know, I mentioned Patrick Corbin. When Corbin was at his best, and I don't know, it was with the Nationals, certainly 19, he was really good. Right. He was throwing over 80% of his two strike sliders in the bottom third and below. I mean, he just executed it at such a high rate. And what happens is the stuff grade on the overall pitch grade on a pitch goes up if it's executed in the optimal place. Okay. Like a lot of sliders, a guy could throw a slider if it's in the middle of the zone, you know, let's just say it's a slightly below average slider. Well, now if he gets it in the bottom third, it goes up and it's average to maybe above average. And you know, there's still, I think teams are probably getting closer to be able to quantify a little bit of how those pitches play off of each other, and actually looking at when pitches break. Okay, so there is something to that, like lateness of break is actually a thing. But it's really hard to teach.
Right. It feels like for when you're watching amateur pitchers, I feel like that is almost always the biggest separator between a good amateur, like thinking about high school pitchers who throw breaking balls. A lot of them will be throwing these very slurvy in between breaking balls where you can kind of pick them up out of the hand early. And then you'll run into like a Joey Oakey or Ryan Sloan, who's throwing like mid 80s as an 18-year-old. And it just feels like there's a late snapping action that is not immediately obvious out of the hand, like some of the other slurvier breaking balls. So it's interesting that they're like quantifying that now.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is one of the next things to be able to take the Newt mound, connect it to TrackMan, and when you see guys that are able to do certain things as far as force into the ground, you will then see the output, okay, that the velocity goes up, or the spin rate goes up, or the vert on a fastball goes up, or the break on a slider is better. And again, I would use the golf analogy that, okay, you when you make a really good swing, you're on time, you're in sequence, the sound that it makes, okay, and the way the ball comes off the club, okay, it goes, you know, 5, 8, 10 yards farther, it's got a better trajectory, it spins better, all of those things that I think that's where the next frontier is, if you will, in developing pitchers.
Will that allow just teams to reverse engineer the best pitches and then like shorten the feedback loop to help train the feel of what those best pitches are, just so you can execute them more consistently?
Yeah, I think reverse engineer is the best way to describe that. And again, even though I'll say that the sequence is pretty similar, there there are some guys who use their back leg more than their front, and vice versa. There's some guys that, you know, they're the way they produce things or what's going on is they rotate a little better, a little differently. That's, you know, that's where they're deriving it from. And so again, you can take guys and I think this is probably some things that you can do with, I don't want to say you'd limit it to lower round guys because, you know, Logan Webb, again, is a really good example. Logan Webb's stuff right out of high school and throwing traditionally from here was pretty generic. And then now he throws it from here and it's crazy good. You know, even though he's not a super hard thrower, but just the action on it and then how those pitches play, and they become unique because it's not something that hitters see all the time. And I think that factors into it as well, that I think I've seen this, and I'll have to say this is anecdotal. I've seen in the last couple of years some guys who, however they ended up moving on the mound, and it may have been that they had to move on the mound in order, they moved on the mound and then where the release is in order to get more strikes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, by doing so, their release is kind of right in the middle of where it would be going to home plate, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Rather than, okay, one thing with Max Scherzer, if you were to look at Scherzer, you know, from day one, and I have some video of Scherzer that I took from behind home plate 10 years ago, where he would be releasing the ball from is way over near third base. And so just that view, that release angle, that guys just don't see that. And then you combine it with his stuff and his ability to throw it for strikes and for chase made him Max Scherzer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in some ways I have done this with some guys, like, hey, you're an 8th or 10th or 12th round draft pick. What you're doing generically probably isn't going to work. So let's try and make some adjustment to where, okay, where you are now releasing the ball from will make, you know, for lack of a better term, and this can simplify it, ball flight. The ball flight will be a little more unique. Mm-hmm. And then if that guy can start adding different pitches to it, that will make it tougher for hitters to deal with as well.
Yeah. I wanted to briefly touch on some of the Braves' young arms that you've been able to work with over the past few years as well. Obviously, it's still a very pitcher-heavy system at the top. You've got young upside arms like Cam Caminiti, J.R. Richie, Didier Fuentes, who Braves fans got to see at the major league level, maybe in some down starts, but still very young and has a lot of stuff. Then you got guys even behind them, Owen Murphy, Briggs McKenzie recently added. I don't know if you just have general thoughts on some of these players, what makes them different or unique, or anything that stands out about coaching those players and working with them, but it is a fun collection of pitchers who do things differently, have different strengths and weaknesses. So I'm kind of curious on your thoughts of maybe the next wave of Braves arms here.
Well, I guess I would, I'll keep it in generic terms because I think you touched on it, that I would look at them as they're unique. And you know, if there's anything about me that anyone should know is I'm a huge believer in developing pitchers' strengths. And sometimes you may have to explore a little. Okay, like I there's a great book. It's out. I forget the name of it. I think it's called The Explorer's Gene. Okay, and the author talks about exploring and exploiting. And I started using this, and I think exploring is something that a lot of really good pitchers do innately. Okay, I'll go back to Strider. Strider spent a whole lot of time exploring on his own to try to create the slider, to try to, you know, develop how he's moving to create his fastball. And so you have to give pitchers the freedom to explore. And then when you find something that really works, you want to exploit it. And again, there's certain things that we have been able to identify that, okay, if a pitch moves in this way, you know, again, I'll go back to the 17 plus vert, 95 plus fastball at the top of the zone. If you can execute that over and over again at a really high rate, it will be successful in the big leagues. And now if you can create something off of that, conversely, if you have multiple fastballs that you can throw for strikes, you can exploit different guys, you know, and especially in the big leagues, the big issue is what are you going to do against opposite handed hitters? You see it all the time. I mean, the platoon advantage is real. It always has been. You go back to Earl Weaver. Okay. Another great book, the book about Weaver called The Last Manager. And it talks about how he kind of, you know, early use of data, if you will. But and back when you had pitching staffs that you had a 10 or 11 man pitching staff and you would have 14 or 15 position players and you could run platoons at five or six of eight positions on the field. And so that's always been real. And now the issue is with a lot of young pitchers, okay, how is he going to get opposite handed hitters out in the big leagues? And so it's taking these guys who, you know, and I also think, you know, the other part of it is there's no perfect size of pitcher. Okay. Pitchers can come in all shapes and sizes, whether it's, again, Strider at 6 foot, Fuentes, you look at his body, you look at Garrett Bauman, who's 6'8". It doesn't really matter. Again, throwing is throwing. You take what a guy, what his body is. And, you know, I think this is coming. I've learned this also by working with the Newt Mound that, you know, taller guys, their sequence, it will look a little differently than shorter guys. Okay, guys with long arms versus arms that are basically average versus short. Okay, guys with shorter arms are going to move a little differently. And so just taking what, you know, how is a guy built? What does his body look like? And where does he throw from naturally? What does his fastball do? Okay, we build off of that. And it's just finding what a guy does well, allowing him to explore. And then when you find something that works, exploit the heck out of it. That's it in a nutshell.
That's awesome. Well, Paul, I think those are kind of all the questions that I wanted to definitely hit on. I feel like we've gotten a good modern education on pitching development, so I appreciate you taking the time. Also wanted to just throw it open to you if there's anything we did not hit on that you want to comment on, any closing thoughts on pitching in general, the landscape, youth pitching, really anything at all. But again, really appreciate you coming on and taking the time. It's been a blast.
Well, thank you. No, I would just say I would be remiss without giving a shout out and a thanks to Brent Strom. That I think, you know, I think he's retired at this point. But you know, he's had a phenomenal career and, you know, not just me, but he's been a guy who has given his time, freely, you know, whether it's going out and doing clinics, you know, talking with young coaches, trying to help coaches, you know, find jobs and move on and better their careers. And I certainly, I wouldn't have been able to do the things that I've been able to do without his mentorship and him getting me into the game. And I think I speak for a lot of guys when I say that.
Awesome. Ben, any final thoughts or comments before we get out of here?
No, that's great. That's awesome to hear. And yeah, I think a lot of pitching coaches around the game who've crossed paths with Brent or have crossed paths with coaches who Brent has influenced would echo those sentiments. And I think that's a large number of people in that group.
Well, yeah, awesome.
I appreciate you guys having me on. I do. I've enjoyed it.
Of course. Well, we appreciate Definitely. You taking the time. So hope you guys enjoyed. For Paul, for Ben, I'm Carlos. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This isn't just a game. It's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.